From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Farm and Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. It is Saturday, May 2nd. New York is the second largest apple-producing state in the country, but last week's spring freeze left farmers with severe crop damage. We hear from local farmers and fruit experts on what this means for the region. Women are one of the fastest-growing groups of hunters in the United States. We chat with author Deborah Lee Luskin about her memoir documenting learning how to hunt as a woman in her 60s. Plus, Rosie Starr chats with artist Steve Teal about a work-in-progress art installation in Narrowsburg about the equinox. And what should you do if you encounter a bear, or on an upcoming workshop at the Catskills Visitor Center? All of that and Keith Hubbard's Star Talk report, but first, news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy says major airlines are stepping in after Spirit Airlines shut down overnight and canceled all flights effective immediately. Duffy says carriers including United, JetBlue, and Southwest are capping ticket prices for stranded passengers trying to rebook canceled flights. NPR's Joel Rose reports the sudden collapse of Spirit comes after years of financial struggles.
Spirit Airlines faced mounting financial pressure because of the war in Iran, which sent the price of jet fuel soaring. But its problems ran much deeper than that. Spirit was a pioneer among ultra-low-cost carriers, keeping its fares down by stripping away amenities that travelers had previously taken for granted and then charging extra for them. But the airline faced increased competition from its larger rivals, which adopted their own basic economy fares. The Florida-based airline has filed for bankruptcy twice since 2024. Spirit has been seeking a $500 million federal bailout, but those talks failed to yield a deal, leaving the airline no choice but to stop flying and prepare to liquidate its assets. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
A federal appeals court is reinstating restrictions on how the abortion pill mifepristone can be prescribed. The Fifth Circuit sided with Louisiana on Friday, blocking rules that allow the medication to be prescribed through telehealth. That means for now, patients must receive the prescription in person, a change that takes effect nationwide. President Trump is sharply condemning claims that the U.S. is not winning the war in Iran.
We get the radical left to say, we're not winning, we're not winning. They don't have any military left. It's unbelievable. It's actually, I believe it's treasonous. Okay, you want to know the truth? It's treasonous.
Trump is calling a law limiting the use of force without congressional authorization, quote, totally unconstitutional. Although, in a letter to congressional leaders, he argued that hostilities have terminated. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard says it will exercise control over 1,200 miles of the country's coastline despite a U.S. naval blockade. Dori Buscarin reports the U.S. this week rejected a peace proposal from Iran delivered by Pakistani mediators.
In a report by the semi-official Fars News Agency, a senior Iranian military official said that a renewed conflict with the U.S. is, quote, likely, and that Iran's armed forces are in full readiness. On Friday, U.S. President Donald Trump said he was unsatisfied with Iran's latest peace proposal and that Iran's leadership was, quote, very disjointed. At least 50 top Iranian officials were killed in U.S. and Israeli airstrikes, including the country's former supreme leader. Peace talks have remained stalled despite a fragile ceasefire since early April. For NPR News, I'm Dori Buscarin in Istanbul.
This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Jason Dole. The most tangible impact of the Iran war is being felt at the pump. In New York, the average price of regular gas is $4.36 a gallon, and in Pennsylvania, it's $4.41, according to AAA. The war and the resulting disruptions to shipping through the Strait of Hormuz has also pushed up fertilizer prices. As Kara Chapman reports for the New York Public News Network, farmers are already feeling the effects.
Almost 70% of farmers in the Northeast can't afford to buy all the fertilizer they need. That's according to a survey conducted by the American Farm Bureau Federation in early April.
It's not a rosy outlook for anybody, really.
David Fisher with the New York Farm Bureau says farmers were already dealing with multiple challenges this year. Then at the end of February, the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran, and that's driven up combined fuel and fertilizer costs by 20 to 40%. Fisher says farmers in the midst of spring planting have to weigh the risk for yield loss depending on how much they do or don't decide to fertilize. And he says dealers don't know if they'll be able to get all the fertilizer farmers will need.
From a nitrogen standpoint, we are probably one of the later growing seasons. So if it runs short towards the end of the season, we could be more in jeopardy than other places across the country or in the world.
And he says Americans need to be aware of the impacts of these events on the food system.
Food security is national security. And, you know, as we saw during COVID, boat doesn't show up, you don't get it. And if it's food that you depend on, that's a concern. And as more farms go out of business and things change, it's very concerning from a national security standpoint.
In Plattsburgh, I'm Kara Chapman for the New York Public News Network.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange, Sullivan, and Rockland, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. Information at CFOSRNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. I'm your host, Kimberly Izar. Well, New York really is the Big Apple. Apples are often, you know, the cliche image that folks think of when they think of New York State, along with, of course, city skyscrapers. But there's a reason for that. New York is the second largest apple producing state in the entire country, averaging about 29.5 million bushels of production annually, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But last Tuesday, early morning, apple farmers in the Hudson Valley and Catskills and really the greater Northeast region were hit with a late spring freeze with temperatures that left many orchards devastated with severe crop loss. I spoke with local farmers and fruit experts earlier this week about what this means for the region and how climate change is increasingly shaping the future of agriculture. Brett Buddy grows all sorts of apple varieties at his farm, Majestic Farm. Crimson Crisps, Pristines, Golden Russets.
One that I really like is called an Asopus Spitzenberg, and that's a native New York apple. You can find it. It was discovered by the Asopus Reservoir.
But his favorite is a sweet, tangy apple called the Ashmead's Kernel that he says tastes unbelievable.
It has the most insane flavor. It reminds me, the intensity is like an apple Jolly Rancher, but it has high acid notes, and then it's also sweet as well. And they're kind of ugly, too. They have, I mean, I think they're ugly gorgeous. Like, they have a russeted skin. They're mostly yellow, but then they get this beautiful orange glow on one side of them where the sun hits them. So they're, like, rough-skinned, but, yeah, they're kind of craggy. I think they're so gorgeous.
Buddy has about 2,500 apple trees at his farm in Mountaindale in Sullivan County. The apples are so tasty that he says customers call him weeks in advance before they're ripe, with promises to take them all. But this year, Buddy isn't so confident that he'll have any apples for sale at his farm. During the early morning hours last Tuesday, the Hudson Valley and greater Northeast region were hit with an overnight frost. Temperatures dropped to as low as 19 degrees in some parts of upstate New York. This came after several days of warm weather that put apple buds into full bloom. For some farmers, the sudden frost meant a near total loss for their fruit crops.
According to the frost charts, it is 100% loss. And I haven't had, usually I go out there and you can slice your buds open and see if there's like a brown, you'll see brownness where the seeds go and stuff like that. And I just don't have it in my heart to really go look. But I know for a fact I have been a victim to the frost charts in the past, and they are wildly accurate.
Like other farmers across the Northeast, Buddy tried to implement frost mitigation efforts. He rented an agricultural drone that blew warm air onto the trees to raise the temperatures.
We were raising the temperature of the orchard about 3 degrees, but as the night wore on, this was 12:30 in the morning, and as the night wore on, the coldest times are like right before sunrise, so it's probably around 6:30. By 5 o'clock, we were at 20 degrees in the orchard, and the drone was only giving us a half a degree lift, and it just didn't seem worth it anymore, so we packed it up at that time.
Apples are New York's most valuable crop, with the state being the second largest apple producer in the country. Jared Bono, director of Cornell University's Hudson Valley Research Laboratory, says Hudson Valley apples are especially vulnerable to erratic weather patterns.
We're further south. Our trees wake up earlier, which means there was more exposed sensitive tissue. So, you know, buds, green leaves, even flowers in the case of stone fruit. So those flower parts, of course, are essential to making fruit this year. Anything below freezing for an extended period of time damages stuff.
Many New York farms in low-lying frost pockets, where cold air accumulates, attempted frost protection efforts last week.
A lot of farms were taking measures like using wind machines, hiring helicopters to blow the air out, even lighting fires in the alleyways and things with brush to keep the fires up, to keep the temperatures up. Everybody employed what they could. So we're expecting some impact this year. It remains unclear to what extent in the crops.
Daniel Heavens is the co-owner of Quartz Rock Vineyard in Marlboro in Ulster County. They grow strawberries, plums, nectarines, and apples. He says last week's frost has left his farm with significant losses.
We sit on the Marlboro Mountain Range, so we're right on top. Usually what happens is the cold air slides down into the valley, and we are a degree or two or three above what the reading is in town. The cold air kind of hung out a bit, and in the low-lying pockets of the farm, it killed off more of the fruit. So we have some pockets where 90% of the grapes were just lost. They're just shriveled. You know, it basically burns the, it looks like the leaves and the buds that came out are burnt a few days later. So they're just shriveled up and they're dying off. It also killed off a lot of our stone fruit. We're going to have zero plums this year, zero cherries this year. The apples, it doesn't look good right now. So for the apples, there's still bloom out there, but they're dead. It takes a while for that to develop and show. So you might be driving around and see apple trees in bloom, and hopefully they're all still alive, everyone that you see. But if you cut that open, you'll start to see brown and black on the inside, and that'll die slowly.
Heaven says how this will impact the rest of their season is still a big unknown.
We sell to local markets and CSAs and roadside stands, things like that. From a wholesale perspective, you know, the grading is super important. I don't know what the grading is going to look like. That really depends on the next 7 to 14 days to kind of see what happens with fruit set. We got to get through that period to really get a better understanding of what things are going to look like.
He says climate change and extreme weather changes has made farming increasingly unpredictable.
The more I describe agriculture to people that aren't necessarily familiar with the agricultural world, it's really like gambling. You can't control certain things. Mother Nature's in charge, and you can try to influence that, like with the wind machines, like with the helicopters, like with the burning of, you know, barrels or smudge pots. But it's you know, Mother Nature's fully in charge.
Brett Buddy of Majestic Farm agrees. He says climate change in the region looks more subtle than some realize.
climate change does not have to be this exotic, crazy event where your neighborhood is flooded. Like, the damage to these apple buds is dictated by a few degrees, and most climate change actually affects us that way. So having extremely warm weather in the springtime, bumping everything forward, and then having outrageously cold weather events after that has been dramatically difficult for us. When I put this orchard in 8 years ago, I looked back at all the weather data for 100 years, and it was clear to me from the weather data that we would lose a crop every 1 to 7 years, and we have lost a crop 3 times now to weather. So, I mean, that's significant. It's a big deal.
In 2025, Majestic Farms' U-Pick organic apple orchard was also closed due to extreme weather.
We had, I believe it was 10 days of rain during the bloom period. And then at the end of the bloom, the last 3 days, it went up to 80 degrees. And all the flowers basically melted off of the trees because they've been exposed to so much moisture. And we had no apples that year. So this is a double whammy. I mean, to have 1 year with no crop is something that we can manage. But because we lost our crop twice, I'm going to be working off farm to, try to supplement our income.
Still, farmers are trying to stay positive. Heavens at Quartz Rock Vineyard says the apples this season may be misshaped, but they're still going to taste delicious. In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill. We'll take a short break, but when we come back, the latest from Keith Hubbard.
Old school. Tonight is Old School Sessions' annual James Brown birthday celebration. We pay tribute to the Godfather, creator of funk, and play James Brown productions. So that's where we're going to be playing tonight. And Chucks is going to be paying tribute to the Godfather with all kinds of treats. Old school, baby.
Tonight at 8, only on Radio Catskill.
Yogi Berra once said, if you come to a fork in the road, take it. For the rest of us, well, choices might be in order. I'm Meg Wolitzer, and this week on Selected Shorts, fiction writers including Ursula K. Le Guin help us make sense of crossroads.
Selected Shorts, Sunday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. If you're just joining us, I'm your host, Kimberly Izar. Well, you know what time it is. This week's Star Talk Report from Keith Hubbard.
For Farm and Country, I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. The Eta Aquarid meteor shower will reach its peak Wednesday morning. The shower has a broad peak, so the next couple mornings will also be a good time to watch. Aquarius will be low in the east before dawn, but the meteors will appear in all parts of the sky. Given dark skies, the Eta Aquarids will produce 10 to 20 meteors per hour. But for our listening area, the number of meteors will be fewer as the Aquarids will favor more southerly latitudes. The further south you go, the later into the morning the sun will rise. The later sunrise means more dark time to watch for meteors, and it will allow Aquarius to climb higher in the sky. Aquarius rises in the early morning hours and does not climb very high in the sky. It is a difficult constellation to pick out, as none of the stars in the constellation are very bright, and the stars do not form a distinct pattern. This year's shower coincides with the waning gibbous moon, which will significantly brighten the night sky. The moon will rise late in the evening and will set after sunrise. This will make an already difficult meteor shower to observe all the more difficult. The Aquarid meteors are bits and pieces of the famous Comet Halley. This will be the first of 2 times that Earth crosses the path of Comet Halley, with the other time being late October. The Eta Aquarid meteor shower will reach its peak this week, but the moon will make viewing conditions unfavorable. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future Star Talk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and Star Talk, This has been Keith Hubbard reminding you to keep looking up.
Thanks so much to Keith for that report. Women are one of the fastest growing groups of hunters in the United States. But author Deborah Lee Luskin says it's only in more recent years where we as a society have really started to learn about and understand the history of women hunters. Deborah is an author, educator, and recently named Artemis Ambassador for the National Wildlife Federation. Next week, from May 7 to 9, she's going to be in Narrowsburg for a series of community events, including a public talk on her memoir, Reviving Artemis, The Making of a Huntress, which explores her journey learning how to hunt deer as a woman in her 60s, grappling with fear, firearms, personal loss, and a changing relationship to the natural world. Joining me now is educator and author of Reviving Artemis, The Making of a Huntress, Deborah Lee Luskin. Deborah, thank you again so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. This is wonderful.
Well, I am so excited for this conversation because, you know, you have lived such a beautiful life. A lot of it has been spent very much in nature. You're a gardener. You're also a hiker. And, you know, I guess more recently, maybe in more recent years, a hunter. And I'd love to just hear a little bit about why you decided to learn how to hunt.
Well, it was a surprise. I'll tell you that.
I had just hiked the Long Trail, which is the footpath that goes from Massachusetts to Canada. And I, you know, it's easy to follow a trail. I'd always wanted to be able to go off trail. And every time I tried, I just got really anxious. It was like learning mathematics, which algebra. I was not good at that. And I get, the whole body anxiety. And I followed my husband, who's very good at just bushwhacking, as it's called. And I was tired of following him. I wanted to be able to create my own path, find my own way in the woods. And I was in the garden where I spent about 30 years, more than 30 years, growing a lot of our own food. And I looked over the fence into the woods and I thought, you know, the deer will tell me how to get through the woods. They have no trouble finding water, food, other society of other deer. They know how to do it. And so I realized I was going to learn to hunt. Now, I should tell you that in Vermont, hunting is still there's a very strong hunting tradition here. And I had met hunters when I first moved here. I'd never met hunters before. But I'd also, when I had this epiphany that I could follow the deer and become a hunter, I was 60 years old. I had never held a firearm in my life. I knew I didn't have enough time to learn how to hunt with a bow. It was just going to be a heavy lift because I was going to have to go into the woods without a trail. But there's a lot of metaphoric value in that. I wanted to do something that was just mine and that I had to find my own way.
Your book, Reviving Artemis, is a memoir. I'd love to hear just about when did you realize in this process that you wanted to write this story down? And what did those early drafts look like?
Well, I knew almost immediately I would write it. And I called it Learning to Hunt for about 5 years of writing it. And then Artemis walked into my life and it became Reviving Artemis. And I have to tell you that writing the memoir was at least as hard as learning to hunt, and that it was surprised. I was surprised at how deep I had to go into my own history. But that's what makes a memoir a memoir. And I went back to my childhood, and I actually remembered the first time I was lost in the woods. It was in the back of a 56 Chevy, our family car. My whole family was in it, and we'd made a wrong turn. And my father got angry in a way that he could and essentially humiliated my mother, who was the navigator. And I thought we were lost. And I said, are we lost? In a tiny little voice sitting behind between my two older brothers. And one of them said, or my mother said, don't cry. One of my brothers called me a crybaby and another one kicked me. And so I thought navigating is not something a girl can do. I grew up with three brothers, no sisters,
at a time, I was born in the middle of the last century, and this was a time when, you know, boys were believed to be better than girls, and that's how I grew up believing that. And it's been a long, I am also now the mother of three daughters, so there is justice in the world. And I always wanted a sister, and they each have two. But it was really, writing it was very hard. And I kept on writing sections and rewriting them. Artemis showed up. I reread the stories about Artemis, and they gave me, and I learned about Artemis of Ephesus. That's really the stunner. Artemis of Ephesus predates Zeus and being the daughter of Zeus and the sister of Apollo. She was, people all over the ancient world came to worship at her temple at Ephesus. Men and women worshiped her. She was the goddess, not just of the hunt and not just of chastity, but also of childbirth and women and wildlife. And so there are also these stories of Artemis as a huntress. Women have been hunting as long as men have. And that was also kind of an epiphany for me. But of course, it makes sense. And then I learned about the dig in Peru. In 2009, they discovered a new mummy body, mummified body, or burial site of what was clearly a hunting chieftain, because this person had been buried with all the tools of hunting and processing meat. They did a DNA test. They had assumed it was a man, but the DNA says, female, between 17 and 19 years old. And now there are archaeologists who are going back through all the data that they have, you know, realizing that it was all red with this male bias. The irony is that right now in the United States, where hunting generally is in decline, women are the only growing group of new hunters.
Even sadly today, I think that even some of those older stereotypes where the man is the hunter and the woman is the gatherer is still held on by some. As we learn, not only from, you know, what you described in history, is that we know that that was and is not true.
Right. Men have had the microphone. They have been telling the stories. They've been creating history and leaving out a lot of women's names and a lot of women's existence and experiences. And it's only recently that women have been able to speak up, or women from ancient times who had a voice have had their voices amplified again.
Deborah, I'm curious what you hope folks take away after reading this book.
My biggest hope is that, and this is a hard one, is that people will embrace ambiguity. Hunting is neither all good nor all bad, but that seems to be the perception. People who hunt think that that's sacred, and people who don't think it's inhumane or disgusting. And I come to hunting actually as a sustenance hunter. It is an outgrowth of my being a locavore since 1975, trying to lower the carbon footprint of my food. And so I raise a lot of my own food. I buy a lot of food locally, directly from farmers. And I try not to drive my car too much. So, and I also try to remember, I try to cook food that remembers the dirt it grew in. So I try not to eat processed foods and packaged foods that have traveled great distances. And I have exceptions to that. No one is 100% follows a completely narrow, well, there are people who do, but they get very, very boring, especially if they try to impose that on you. But I drink wine, I drink whiskey, I have olive oil. There's certain things you can't grow in Vermont, like coffee and chocolate. You know, these are part of a necessary diet, necessary parts of a diet. But what I hope people take away is the nuances of our relationship to the natural world. Food is probably one of the few things that brings us closest to nature. There are a lot of people, I think, if it's been studied, there are people who spend less than 6 seconds a day outside. And if people don't go outside, they don't understand why it's important to conserve the natural world.
You are going to be in our neck of the woods in a few weeks, or in May, in Narrowsburg. So for folks in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania, if you've been enjoying hearing about what it's like to write a memoir and want to know more about this memoir that Deborah has written, she will be in Narrowsburg for a number of events from May 7th to 9th. There will be an author talk on May 7th, a memoir writing circle on May 8th, and a book reading on May 9th. That's going to be a busy weekend for you. What can folks expect during that weekend?
Well, there are three very different events. The first is a phage session, which is run by Tustin Social. And I think I will be speaking about second chances there, because I have a new book that's Reviving Artemis came out in November. And last Friday, my novel Into the Wilderness came out for the second time. And it's a novel, and it's actually not about the wilderness. It's about a New Yorker coming to Vermont and in 1964. And it's what's called A Silver Love. The characters are in their mid-60s, and it's a second chance for them for love. Reviving Artemis is also a second chance for me. Well, it's probably my 700th chance to learn how to navigate the untracked woods. But I did it. So I'll be talking about that and about Reviving Artemis. And then the writing circle. I've been running a writing circle since 2016 and teaching writing since 1980, formally teaching writing since 1980. I started at Columbia when I was a graduate student there. And a writing circle is this very wonderful way of people finding confidence, writing in community with support. Whatever they write, I start by saying, you already have a gold star, an A plus, you've passed the test. This is just fun. Whatever you write is great. And we use a free writing model, but I give prompts and we will go outdoors. It's from 5 o'clock until 8 o'clock. It's at a private home, and there is a registration and a fee. And then on Saturday at 2 o'clock at the 108, One Grand and the 108 are hosting an author event. And that's pretty much the traditional. I'll talk about the book. I'll read a little bit from the book. I'll answer questions, and I'll sign copy.
You can catch Deborah in Narrowsburg from May 7th to 9th. More information at onegrandbooks.com on all the events. Deborah, thank you again so much for chatting and best of luck next week.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
We'll take a short break, but when we come back, a work in progress art installation about the equinox. That's up next.
New music just keeps on coming. From bands that have been around for many decades to first releases, new music is the power behind the development and innovation in folk music. So, next time on The Wackaloo of Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, it's New Music Monthly, a full hour of new folk music. Won't you join me Sunday afternoon at 3?
On last week's Wait Wait, Josh Gondelman wondered, yeah, that Chinese robot won a half marathon, but is it truly human?
Do you think the robot can't stop telling other robots that it just ran a half marathon?
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us this week as we venture to San Diego to talk to the anchor man who made that city famous, Ron Burgundy himself. That's the news quiz that always stays classy. Wait Wait from NPR.
Wait Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Farm and Country here on Radio Catskill. I'm Kimberly Izar. Springtime for me is often a season of renewal and change. And so when Farm and Country contributor Rosie Starr told me about this art installation about the spring equinox, I got really excited. Rosie Starr recently spoke with artist Steve Deal about a work-in-progress art installation in Narrowsburg about the equinox. Here is Rosie and Steve in conversation, more about the project.
For Radio Catskill, this is Rosie Starr in Narrowsburg
on Bridge Street. I made my way behind Maison Bourgogne. It's an old bus depot, and it's filled with antiques. The reason why I'm here, I'm curious about a project, a work in progress by the artist Steve Deal. And the project is called Equinox. Steve and I agreed to meet here on the site of the project. It's early April, a sunny and chilly morning. Steve, thanks for allowing me to pursue my curiosity about a project called Equinox.
You're welcome, Rosie. I'm happy to be here and to talk to you about this project. I've made a whole series of paintings, somewhat loosely based on astronomical events. And this one in particular is focused on equinox. So I started this painting on the spring equinox, which was March 20th. And it will be outside, exposed to all weather and elements and nature until September 19th. So from one equinox in 2026 until the next one.
Okay. Tell me why you chose that parenthesis of time.
I like the way you said that parenthesis. It is kind of like two bookends. What we have is the launch of the painting. It starts on an equinox, and then on September 19th, there will be an exhibition at the local gallery, DVAA, the Alliance Gallery. And on that date, September 19th, it's a Saturday, I plan to roll the painting down the street and install it in the gallery. It's right now, it's fixed to a kind of a sled device that I built. It's 8 feet long, and the back end of it has a couple of wheels, and there will be a piece where I just roll it down the street and then disassemble it and hang it in the gallery. All of this, by the way, will be documented by a friend of mine who's a filmmaker, Josh Kozo. He's agreed to do this whole project with me, so it's a good collaboration.
Well, it's good that you're getting the word out to it, and it really deserves some observation. Let's start with the fact that we're standing in front of the painting. It's horizontal, and it's literally overlooking the Delaware River. It's so curious. Usually you see a painting hanging on the wall, but you're not working vertically. You're working horizontal, and it's exposed to the elements.
Exactly. The material I chose is a steel panel. It's actually galvanized steel that is the same material that you use for HVAC conduit. And I was really fortunate to have another great collaboration with John Coda and Sons in Sparrowbush. And this collaboration involved working with a couple of their people, in particular Chris, who took my design and created a steel panel, which is 34 inches by 89. Very specifically, it's cut from a sheet of 4x8 galvanized metal. And then the surface is framed out by me, and some parts of it are primed with specific primer for the steel. And then the surface is gessoed, and I've purposefully left open some places where I used tape. So the tape exposes the steel underneath it, and the paint formerly was on top of it. So I painted the whole surface, and then I lifted the tape a couple weeks later, and it left, of course, you know, the bare steel underneath it. So the whole idea is process. Yes, it's about the place, and it's about the time. And I call this a landscape because it's very specific about a place and time.
What I want to interject now is something that I personally am curious about, and I'm sure the listeners may join me on this. The word equinox to me always meant the day and the night is equal to each other. And over the years, I've learned the indigenous people observed equinox and perhaps practice their agriculture around it. But there's also the science of the equinox, where it's an actual measurement going over the equator. Can you talk about all of that?
Sure. So as we know, the Earth has a certain tilt to it. I think it's about 23 degrees or so. And so when the Earth's tilt meets the sun's equator, we have equal days and equal nights. And then on the other side of that, of course, we have the longest day and the longest night opposing those. So you can sort of imagine the orbit as being cut into four sections. So in this painting, I tried to capture some of that symbolism because I divided the painting into a white daylight area and then the steel below it. And those are equal sections. And then let's just say the transition between those, which you might call twilight or something like that, there are these intervening, these woven sections of steel opposing the white paint.
I'm looking forward to visiting this from now until September and seeing the changes along with you. Talk a little bit about your other body of work that perhaps led you to this point.
I have a background both in mathematics and art. I teach math at a high school in Queens, and this has always been where my art has gone for at least 30 years. I've always had some interest in science and math, along with seeing where the intersection, let's say, of that plus art might occur. A lot of my work ties together with some astronomy or math. The measurements for this painting are very specific and have to do with this mathematician from the 13th century named Fibonacci. Fibonacci numbers are included in this work in various places. I've also published two books about science and math and art together, the symbolism, the history of it. That's where my work has been. A lot of these other paintings that you'll see in September at the Alliance Gallery are connected with astronomy. For instance, one of the first paintings I did had to do with the meteor shower that occurs every August. It's called the Perseids. And I named this first painting in the series after Andromeda. And that particular painting, which you'll see in the gallery in September, was created so that it was in the woods behind my house. Actually, the woods are my studio, except for this one painting, which is behind Maison Bergon. The painting Andromeda was meant to sort of symbolize the princess named Andromeda. The myth of Andromeda has to do with her being chained to a rock. It's called Dragging Andromeda. And I took this painting up into the woods and tied it to a rock for a year. And then when the next Perseid meteor shower came the following August, I took it away. So symbolically rescued by Perseus. And that's, if anyone is interested, that meteor shower is named after Perseus, the constellation. So that was one of the first paintings that I tried. Others have dealt with seasons, such as spring, summer, autumn, winter. They're actually timepieces. So it's interesting to me to see how they relate to nature and what evolves through time with those specific works.
I love that you interject performance art, if I may be so.
Yeah, you can say that, sure. Yeah. It's a bit about performance. So in September, we'll hang the painting.
I very much look forward to that. And will you reveal the Fibonacci number that you used?
So it's 34 inches high and 89 inches wide. Those are specific Fibonacci numbers. The specific numbers are found in the lengths of these open areas of steel. The Fibonacci numbers and the Fibonacci sequence has really fascinated both artists and mathematicians for centuries. It is based on the golden ratio, the so-called golden ratio, that architects often use. Sometimes it's purposeful, sometimes it's not, but it's considered to be an ideal proportion. So the interesting thing is this number shows up in lots of things, in nature, in plants, in spirals, in galaxies, in things like pine cones and pineapples, sunflowers. If you measure a person's height and divide it by the length from their belly button to the ground, you get about 1.6. So is it a coincidence? Who knows? Maybe not. Maybe this is one of those universal numbers that just shows up for some unexplained reason. But I've put some of those numbers in here. It actually is a really good size, this painting. Ideally, it's a long horizontal piece, 34 by 89. And if you add 55 in there, that's another Fibonacci number. So that's what you get.
I learned about Fibonacci decades ago when I picked up a pine cone in my yard and was mesmerized by the beauty of the structure of what I was looking at. And I had to just go on like a child about how beautiful this was. And an architect friend of mine said, "That's Fibonacci."
Lots of people probably know about this, but they don't know the specifics. To me, it's fascinating. It's a real connective point. I've had lots of exhibitions back in New York City, back in the 90s and the 2000s. I've had some really great opportunities to show my work and to actually give some lectures about it too, in various places, public lectures.
In between now and September, we have the solstice in June.
Exactly. Because it's about process, my friend Josh Kozo and I will be documenting at various times along the way. He's putting this film together that will be shown at the gallery in September. He's interviewed some people. Thankfully, they've been really interested also in the project. It's going to be really interesting to see everything come together and to note what might have changed over time. As I said, it's very specific to a place and time. So this painting, it's here for now. I would encourage people to visit the store, Maison Bergogne, and just walk through the back and look at it. We respectfully ask that you don't touch the surface because it's supposed to really just talk about the natural events that are occurring around it. Take a look and take pictures of it if you want, and let's see what happens in September.
Thank you very much once again for sharing and allowing my curiosity to be satisfied.
You're welcome. Very welcome, Rosie. I appreciate, as I said, it's really nice to talk about it. Thank you.
More information on the work of Steve Diehl is available on his website, sensinggeometry.com.
Thanks to Rosie for bringing us that conversation. So one of the best things about living where we live is our ability to go hiking and go hiking on so many different trails. I really enjoy being outside and being outdoors with my friends or even just on my own when I need a little bit of solitude. And for the most part, you know, hikes usually go as planned. Sometimes we'll get a little bit lost, but I think there's a lot of fun in that too. But no matter what, I have learned that preparation is everything when it comes to hiking. Still, there is, you know, so much more that you can always know from what do you do when you encounter wildlife to navigating changing trail conditions. Having the right knowledge can make all the difference. Next Saturday, May 9th, outdoor educators with the Trailbound Project will be hosting a workshop focused on hiking safety and bear encounters in the Catskills at the Catskills Visitor Center. I spoke with
Joe Galvin and Scott Fitterman of the Trailbound Project and Diana Richards at Catskill Center for Conservation and Development earlier about what participants can expect from the workshop to explore the outdoors safely and sustainably. Joe and Scott, I'd love to just start with you both because I think that the Trailbound Project is a really cool project. And it's also an opportunity, right, for folks to experience the outdoors and teach people about the wilderness in a safe way. I'd love to just hear about why you decided to start the project and what was the need that you were hearing from people?
Yeah, so we've been almost at it for almost 4 years. And myself and Scott are both on New Jersey Search and Rescue. We've been on about 9 or 10 years. And really during COVID is when I think we can all relate that outdoor recreation really started rocketing up. People were getting more involved with it. And we were getting a lot of calls during that time. And for nothing crazy, just seeing a lot of people misplaced, didn't have maps, needed help walking out on the trail. And we saw the need that there's so many people looking to recreate, but there's no place out there to increase their skills. And we were already officers on search and rescue, teaching our team, other search teams. And we thought, you know, there's no place to go. Why don't we become part of the solution and take what we do for search and rescue and convert all the courses and the lessons for the general public so that we could, our mission is to fill the woods with capable people. So we just started developing everything to be really incremental, whether it's navigation, wilderness first aid, even intro to backpacking, building people up from hiking in a mile and learning how to set up a tent, learn about cook systems, to now trips in the Catskills where we're heading off trail and remote campsites or taking things on like the Burroughs Range, Adirondack, snowshoeing. So it all started right after COVID, seeing the need for people really wanted to further themselves, but not having a resource to go to.
That's awesome. And you talked about the hands-on skills that people learn, but I imagine that there are probably some interpersonal and communication skills that people probably pick up through what you described. Can you talk to me a little bit about that as well?
I think the best thing with just communication and getting others involved with the Trailbound Project has really been the community. That's been the really huge thing. So we're not a guide service. So we're always trying to empower everyone at every course, make sure they not just go through everything, but actually retain the skills and can pay it forward to someone else. But the big thing I wanted to touch base on with the community and that kind of communication is all the relationships, all the friendships, because we'll have a monthly free event called Dirt Time. And we just ran one live on Friday, and we had about 90 people show up, and it's free. It runs from like 5 till 10 p.m. We work on skills for the first hour or so. We have some food, light up the campfire, and so many people come and make friends, form relationships, and plan their own hikes, plan trips, and it really becomes something bigger than just the education.
And it wasn't exactly planned, but it's self-fulfilling, right? So that communication, they show up at Dirt Time or they show up at some other event and somebody has a question. And because these Trailbounders have already taken courses, they know the stuff and they're able to teach it to everybody else. And that cements it in their mind. And really the one of the other goals besides filling the woods with capable people was to have people come through the courses and the programs and develop this community and everything, but become instructors themselves.
I love that. I love when the student becomes the teacher, as they say.
Grasshopper.
Exactly. So, well, the Trailbound Project is going to be hosting another fun workshop focused on bear encounters and hiking safety at the Catskill Center next Saturday, May 9th. Before we get into what the workshop could look like, Diana, I'm going to shift to you. You're with the Catskill Center, and I'd love to just hear a little bit more about how, you know, what types of programming and events that the center offers and how this workshop fits into that.
Sure. Yeah. We actually partner with different organizations to help protect and preserve the Catskills. We have different programs, anything from our CRISP invasive species program. We also have a stewards program where we help teach responsible recreation at busy trailheads. And then we also provide programs at the Catskills Visitor Center, which is also part of our programming. And we decided, well, I actually personally took a Wilderness First Aid program with the Trailbound Project years ago. And I love what they do. I love how they teach it. It was very engaging. I went to one of the dirt times afterwards, which was great, made some connections, and just stayed in contact with them over the years. So when I started working at the Catskill Center, it just aligned perfectly. So when I got into this programming role, they were one of the first people that I called, because they really help teach responsible recreation in the Catskills. And that's kind of what we want to do for the community. And then visitors that are coming to visit the Catskills. And hopefully, you know, they'll learn different responsible ways to recreate and keep our natural resources as good as they are now.
So I had no idea that you had also participated in the Trailbound Project, which I think makes this conversation even more special. What is something that surprises people they learn?
For me, it surprises me how quickly in an actual situation I might forget things. And so taking these courses, even though I've done a Wilderness First Aid course many times, I learn something new every single time.
Well, the workshop in May is a hands-on workshop. I'm curious if you can give a bit of a sneak peek as to some of the things that people might learn, whether that's what they should do when they encounter a bear or a snake, or what should their first aid kit be when they hit the trails.
Yeah, no, it's a great workshop. It touches base a little bit on everything. We do talk a lot about overall animal encounters, especially how to limit the negative ones, and bears is a big one, you know, and we always lead with that we're entering their home and we want to be really conscious of things you can do and then things what you don't do. So we go in different situations. They can learn about coyotes, some snake bites, you know, what to do, what not to do. And it's not just the animal encounters either. It is bear awareness, but it's also hiking safety. So anyone coming out will also get a sneak peek at a good app that they can use for trip planning. It will actually give a little bit of a live demo, and we'll actually talk about how you can use this app to not only plan out hikes for yourself, but you can actually share links and QR codes with loved ones so they can actually live track you as you're on your adventure with cell service. So people get a sneak peek at that. We'll get into overall hiking safety too, what to do with inclement weather, how to handle various situations, different water filters. So we'll touch base on a lot of cool stuff.
And how can folks register for the event?
Yeah, so on the Catskill Visitor Center website, there is a link there for registration. They can also head to our website, trailboundproject.com, and on our schedule page, they can copy and paste the link there and register there. And I'll lead that all the funds are going to go as a donation towards the Catskill Visitor Center. So not only going to learn some really cool stuff, but you're also supporting a great cause.
A few happenings in our community the next few days. Today, May 2nd, is going to be the first Ram Fest in Calicoon. We heard from the Farmhouse Project last week about this event on Farming Country, and now it's actually happening, which is so exciting. Ram Fest is going to be from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. It's presented by the Farmhouse Project and Black Walnut, and this inaugural event brings together farmers, foragers, artisans, gardeners, and local food and beverage businesses to celebrate the love of rams and springtime. And then on Tuesday, May 5th, Penn State Extension hosts a virtual webinar on frontiers in forest health, hemlock conservation. That's going to be at 8 a.m. Participants will explore the ecological importance of the eastern hemlock, the threats it faces from invasive pests, and practical strategies to support conservation and long-term forest health. More events on our community calendar on our website at wjffradio.org. And that's all for this week's show. This show was produced by the Radio Catskill editorial team and post-production by Ronald Kelson. Stick around. Up next, it's Cats Cast with Brett Berry. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. I'll catch you next week.
Support comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, fighting for clean air, land, and water since 2008, both locally and beyond.
Information online at their Main Street storefront in Narrowsburg or their office in the Narrowsburg Union. DamascusCitizens.org. Radio Catskill, keeping Pennsylvania voters connected. Pennsylvania's primary election is May 19th. The last day to register or change your party status to vote in the Pennsylvania primary is May 4th. Voters can apply for a mail-in ballot for any reason. The last day to apply for an absentee or mail-in ballot for the primary election is May 12th. More info is at vote.pa.gov. This is Radio Catskill, keeping Pennsylvania voters connected.
On This Old House Radio Hour, cyber thieves are trying to break into your house through your Wi-Fi. Here's how to stop them.
There's a way you can actually see who's sitting on your network or what devices are still on your network. And so what I would do is remove them.
Plus, comedian Alonzo Bowden on the horrors of the comedian's condo. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.